coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. President Trump announced his latest nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court this week. And one local legal observer says if conservative Brett Kavanaugh is confirmed, the impact will be substantial.
Oh, there's no question. It's a major tectonic shift in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court.
Widener University Delaware Law School Dean Rod Smola joins us to talk about what a Justice Kavanaugh could mean. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine work getting started here in Delaware to create a statewide system of care for drug overdose patients. And our arts playlist brings us more on a new music festival coming to Fort DuPont. Plus, another sampling of work produced by students in our Generation Voice Youth Media Program in this week's Enlighten Me. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. President Trump named his latest nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court this week, tapping Brett Kavanaugh to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. Kavanaugh, who currently sits on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, is President Trump's second pick for the High Court, joining Neil Gorsuch, who filled the vacancy created by the death of Justice Antonin Scalia. This pick is considered a critical one, because while Justice Gorsuch replaced a fellow conservative in Justice Scalia, the 53-year-old Kavanaugh, also considered conservative, will, if confirmed, replace Justice Kennedy, often a swing vote in 5-4 decisions by the High Court. So what do we know about Kavanaugh? What impact could he have on the direction of the Supreme Court? And what can we expect to see in his confirmation hearings? Earlier this week, I sat down with Widener University Delaware Law School Dean Rod Smola, who's argued before the Supreme Court, to examine those questions and more.
You know, we've seen Judge Kavanaugh broadly described as a Washington insider with a strong conservative record. Is that a fairly accurate assessment of him?
There's no question. I mean, he obviously has plenty of experience inside Washington. He had experience inside the White House. He's been on the District of Columbia Court of Appeals. And he is a very solid conservative jurist who I think is going to be very reliably conservative on all the major issues facing the court.
And this pick obviously seems to hold potential to have a much more substantial and lasting impact on the High Court long term, because it replaces Justice Kennedy, often seen as a swing vote in many cases. How significantly do you feel a Justice Kavanaugh would shift the court?
Oh, there's no question. It's a major tectonic shift in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. We've had a court that for almost all of my professional life as a lawyer and a law professor and law school dean has been very evenly divided, with three or four strong liberals on the court at any given moment, three or four strong conservatives on the court, and one or two people in the middle. And now for the first time in decades, for the first time since really before World War II, there will be five very strong, committed, highly intelligent conservative jurists on the court. And that will have potentially a dramatic impact on American life. And we've all heard the debates. It could easily result at some point in the future in overruling Roe v. Wade and abortion rights. I think that's the most likely major consequence. It, in my view, will likely at some point in the near future, if he's confirmed, end affirmative action in admissions at universities. Obviously, another very, very closely watched issue are matters relating to sexual orientation and same-sex marriage. It was a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court of the United States written by Justice Kennedy that made same-sex marriage a constitutional right. It's not as clear to me that that is in peril. That is a tougher one, because there is a legal doctrine. It's got a Latin name. It's called stare decisis. It basically means that precedents should be adhered to typically and not overturned lightly. Of course, lower courts are absolutely bound to follow Supreme Court precedent. Lower courts have no discretion to disagree with the Supreme Court. But the Supreme Court is not bound to respect its own precedents. It can overrule its own past rulings, but it shouldn't do so lightly. And one of the classic factors that a court will consider in deciding whether to overrule one of its past precedents is how disruptive the overruling would be. And my personal hope is that even if there are justices on the court who wouldn't have voted in favor of same-sex marriage in the first instance, we know there are four because they voted against it and they're on the court. Justice Gorsuch, let's assume, would vote the same way that Justice Scalia had. And let's imagine that Judge Kavanaugh is confirmed and he becomes the fifth vote. Still, those five justices will have to ask themselves, how disruptive to the country would this be? Because there have been all these marriages that have been already consummated, the people of the same gender. States have changed their rules. Society has settled into this new reality. And it would be, I think, very dislocating for us to turn back that clock. So I think it's possible same-sex marriage could survive a five-justice conservative majority in a way that abortion might not. Abortion doesn't have quite the same disruption of existing relationships as same-sex marriage does. Basically, I am saying that there would be a profound change in our constitutional law. Another point to keep in mind, and I think that I would expect Republican supporters to make this point as a positive. Democrats, I'm sure, will dismiss the point. It doesn't mean, if a five-justice conservative majority comes on, that every state will ban abortion. It doesn't mean that if, for example, there were new rules on same-sex marriage, every state would roll back the clock, but it would return those issues to the states. So on something like abortion, you might see 30 states that continue to allow it. You might see 20 states that ban it in various forms. And so we'd have a patchwork of different sets of legal rules. And something not many people talk about, but every state has a constitution. Mm-hmm. State Supreme Courts can interpret their own constitutions. And you might see some state Supreme Courts that would say, even if Roe v. Wade's been overruled under the federal constitution, we think it remains a fundamental right under our state constitutions. So what you're hearing from me, Tom, is that it would have a profound effect on the court, a more complex set of effects overall in our society, a much more state-by-state set of effects.
You mentioned some of these larger issues like abortion, same-sex marriage, affirmative action. Are there some lower profile issues that maybe people aren't thinking about but could have similarly widespread effects?
Yeah, so the court takes about 100 cases a year. And of those 100 cases, 7 or 8 make the news as blockbusters on big issues like religion or speech or race, presidential power. So what are the other 80 or 90 cases that the court takes? And the answer is that a large part of the court's diet involves the interpretation of federal statutes, federal laws, the actions of federal agencies that don't get that culture war sort of attention, but can have a giant effect on environmental matters, regulation of business, labor disputes, all sorts of things like that. And to the extent that those are interpreted in a more conservative manner, that will also impact the direction of our government in many ways.
How quickly might some of these issues wind up before the court? Will it take some time, or are there already cases in the pipeline on a lot of these issues that could be heard relatively quickly?
It will take some time. And so let's take abortion. First, you'll have to have states that take the cue and enact laws that in some ways severely restrict abortion or perhaps try to ban abortion entirely, except, for example, to save the life of the mother. Well, those laws will instantly be declared unconstitutional by lower courts because lower courts have no choice. But that litigation will take some time. And so it may take a year or two or three for that litigation to wind its way through. And then the Supreme Court itself has to decide how quickly it wants to take up an issue like that. Mm-hmm. Maybe they want to let a few years pass and then finally do it, or maybe they're willing to do it immediately. It only takes 4 justices to vote to take a case. And so that's, it's called the rule of four. And so typically, if the four believe there's a fifth that would vote with them, they may be inclined to do it. So, you know, realistically, if we are asking when would Roe v. Wade likely be litigated and be before the Supreme Court, hard to believe it could be sooner than 2 years, let's say. Affirmative action, same sort of thing. You'd have to have a lawsuit brought challenging a university's affirmative action policies. There's actually a suit right now pending against Harvard, in which Asian Americans are claiming that Harvard's affirmative action policies hurt Asian Americans. But it could be brought against some other university, more likely a public university than a private one. And again, it will take a year or two or three for that to work its way through lower courts. But at that point, after 2 or 3 years of litigation, the Supreme Court could easily take that and say, no, not anymore. It's a violation of the Equal Protection Clause and a violation of federal civil rights statutes for public or private universities to do it. So the answer is it won't happen overnight. It takes a while for the issue to be set up, and there has to be the will on the part of the court to take it. But within 2 or 3 years, I think we would start to see some profound changes.
Some have also pointed to Judge Kavanaugh's view on investigating a sitting president in a Minnesota Law Review article in 2009. He argued while he doesn't view the president above the law, investigations into the president could be a significant distraction, one that's unnecessary given Congress's ability to hold the president accountable via impeachment. With the ongoing Mueller investigation as a backdrop, how significant is this issue that's being raised by some folks?
I have to say that I'm not as persuaded that this is as significant. First of all, there's been a fairly broad scholarly consensus for quite some time that it's doubtful that you could indict a sitting president. So that position that the judge took as a scholar is not wildly out of what a lot of people believe, both liberals and conservatives, and quite possibly what some of the liberal justices on the Supreme Court believe about presidential power. So I don't think that that in itself is so striking. And then more generally with regard to presidential power, that is not an issue historically that divides so neatly along ideological lines in the way that we typically think of the court today. So it's not an area in which you can be sure how a conservative justice will vote or how a liberal justice could vote. Justice Scalia, for example, had very strong views involving separation of powers and was willing at times to write against the executive branch on matters. So to my view, that's in the mix because President Trump is so controversial, because people are so, there's such a divisiveness about his presidency. There's no question that Democrats will use that as one of the arguments to try to persuade one or two more moderate Republicans or one of the two independent senators to switch their way. But if you're just asking me as a constitutional law scholar, I don't see that as so obviously having a profound effect on the court.
Since you moved toward the confirmation process, what do you expect from that process in this particular case, considering, again, Judge Kavanaugh's conservative nature, and also there's still that kind of lingering bitterness, I think, with Democrats over the way Merrick Garland's nomination was handled.
There's no question. I mean, I believe, somewhat sadly for the country, but I believe it'll be one of the most divisive moments of modern times. It's really a perfect storm. We've not had the solid four conservatives and four liberals on the court with the tie vote in play in decades and decades and decades. And so there just has not been this moment in which it was so obvious that so much was at stake and that a major ideological divide was at stake. And so there's that part of it. There's the general tenor of divisiveness in the country on from both the left and the right. The protests at restaurants and so on in public places of members of against the Trump administration. There's just the huge polarization in our politics, and with the stakes so high, with the polarization in the country, with the closeness of the vote, even though it would be an uphill battle to defeat Judge Kavanaugh or to delay the vote until after the elections, in which case the Senate could perhaps swing to the Democratic side. There's so much at stake. There's so much opportunity to galvanize the base of the right and the base of the left over this issue. It's something voters really care about. So the midterm elections become a plebiscite on it. You've only got to get one or two votes to switch. I just see it as a battle royale. And I think there'll be day after day after day of very divisive hearings and very divisive debate in the Senate. And who knows what the timetable will be. You know, Senator McConnell is determined to move it along and get it done before. Politics are unpredictable. We don't know what issue will come up. As people look into his record, who knows? If something were to come up, and you know, the Democrats, the clock's on their side. They want to delay, try to run out the clock. So I think it'll be very divisive, and in a certain way, that's unfortunate. It's not, I don't think, good for the civility of the country, and it's not necessarily good for the rule of law and the respect for the court, because it makes the court look like just another political branch of government.
Thanks to Widener University's Delaware Law School Dean Rod Smola for his time this week. And next up on The Green, Governor John Carney is poised to sign a bill allowing for the creation of a statewide system of care for drug overdose patients. We examine what that might look like and the impact it could have as a tool in battling the opioid crisis. So stay with us. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Governor John Carney is poised to sign a bill allowing for creation of a statewide system of care for drug overdose patients. The goal of the system would be to offer the same quality of care to anyone suffering from an overdose, no matter where in the state they enter the system. Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino has more.
Keith Pettiford works Friday and Saturday nights in the emergency department at St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington. He's an engagement specialist from Brandywine Counseling just down the road and has worked in drug counseling for going on 2 decades. Pettiford started at St. Francis a couple months ago, working during the hospital's peak rush hours. His job is to help connect overdose patients with treatment for their addiction.
It is less a job today than a responsibility, a humanitarian responsibility.
When people overdose on opioids, first responders or emergency department doctors administer naloxone to reverse the effects of the overdose and save the patient's life. Once the patient is stable, Pettiford sits down with them to discuss treatment options going forward. He tries to make a connection.
The first thing I would do when I engage a client is I try to establish or identify the readiness to change.
But that can often be difficult. In the ED, Pettiford approaches a nurse to ask the status of a young couple who were each admitted for an overdose. She tells him they have already left.
They caused a commotion, conductions, fit, and left. So, luckily, they'll probably do that.
If the patient does express a willingness to seek treatment, Pettiford consults with the doctors to decide what will work best for the individual. He then references a database to see what's available.
So if I encounter an individual tonight who we identify may benefit from a detox initially before he or she moves on to another level of care, we can go on to the database and look at the detox centers in the state, see their availability, bed availability, and then plug them in.
Since his start, Pettiford has been able to get 11 people to enter into long-term addiction care after surviving an overdose. And he still stays in touch with each of them to be sure they're sticking with it. But his position at St. Francis is a new one. He was brought on by Dr. Sandra Gibney. Gibney is the Associate Chairman of Emergency Services at St. Francis. She is also a member of the state's Behavioral Health Consortium, the group that recommended Delaware implement an overdose system of care. She says St. Francis is going through a paradigm shift in how it addresses the treatment of people who are suffering from substance abuse disorder.
In the past, individuals would come in, they would get acute reversal drugs, and they would be treated until medically stable, at which time they typically would be discharged from the hospital.
But now St. Francis seeks to connect those people with long-term care right away. And Gibney says Keith Pettiford's position is just the beginning. She expects the hospital will eventually be able to fund more in-house addiction counselors, as well as psychiatric telemedicine services and even on-site medication-assisted treatment with buprenorphine or methadone.
It is my mission to make St. Francis be the leader in how opioid and substance abuse care is done in the emergency room.
And the goal of the overdose system of care bill is to set the standard statewide at all 9 of Delaware's hospitals, among first responders, and potentially at stabilization centers the legislation allows the state to create. Delaware Public Health Director Dr. Carol Rattay says once the bill is signed, it will create a committee to iron out the details and set protocol.
We're going to, as quickly as possible, get those people named and bring people together to start having the conversations around, you know, what is needed in EMS, what do we want to see in our emergency departments, what do people think about the stabilization centers, can we make this work?
Delaware would be first to start a statewide system for overdose care. Rattay says the state is in a unique position to do so, in part because of its size. She adds the system could serve as a model for other states to follow.
I do believe that we will be setting a blueprint for many other states. I mean, all states have a trauma system of care in place. And so, you know, this is a model that all states have embraced for other areas.
Overdose deaths in Delaware have gone up for the past 5 years, with 345 people dying in 2017. And first responders administered naloxone more than 2,700 times last year to just over 1,900 patients. The top two goals outlined in the overview of the overdose system of care bill are to decrease overdose deaths and decrease repeat overdose incidents. For Delaware Public Media, I'm Nick Shalino.
Thanks, Nick. And we have more to come on The Green, including our latest arts playlist. That's up next, after a check of your local headlines from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. This September, the Fort DuPont Redevelopment Corporation is hosting its first ever music festival. The one-day Fortify Fest is set for Saturday, September 29th on the grounds of Fort DuPont, now a historical mixed-use community. In this week's Arts Playlist, Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele chats with festival coordinator Mark Kleinschmidt about the event that will bring local bands and national touring tribute acts together on two stages.
The festival's name is Fortify, and that comes from, you know, obviously Fort DuPont, and the kind of the concept behind it is Fort DuPont has been a long-standing military base here in Delaware, decommissioned in 1947, and has been looking for a new use. And over the last few years, that new use has started to take shape with a large redevelopment of the property that'll include residential, commercial, entertainment, but it'll be keeping the historic character of Fort DuPont in place and using many of the historic buildings are there. And so we've developed this concert or all-day music festival as a way to kind of help draw people in to see the new Fort DuPont.
Man, what a great location for a music festival. Fortify Fest is, as you mentioned, a day-long music festival. It's going to be bringing local bands, national touring tribute acts together on two stages for an incredible day of outdoor music. Let's talk about some of the music.
Sure. I mean, the idea was we wanted to get music, genres of music that people know and really enjoy. And so what we thought would be interesting is to get some national tribute bands that will focus in on, you know, the music that, of the great artists like Led Zeppelin, the Grateful Dead, Allman Brothers, David Bowie, and Bob Marley. But what we thought would become really unique is if we have those national tribute bands, but paired them up with local artists that play similar kind of music. And so what we've done is we'll have two stages. We'll have the local artists play in the same genre of music, and then we'll have the tribute band come. So you'll get a really good dose of that feeling of that different kind of music. So we'll have classic rock, jam band, reggae, and then an assortment of other rock and roll music by The Police, Joan Jett, and David Bowie. So there should be something for everyone. And it's and a great outdoor venue, the Fort DuPont, a 17-acre parade ground is where the concert will be held.
Who came up with this idea? This is just a fantastic idea.
It was kind of a collaboration of a number of people, but we're working with Gable Music Ventures, and they put on a lot of unique music festivals in the area. They are the folks that are responsible for something that's very popular in Wilmington, which is coming up, the Ladybug Festival, which is July 20th in Wilmington. And they've done a number of other unique, and that's their niche, is doing unique music festivals. So we're excited to be working with them.
Do you expect this event to be family friendly?
Yes, and that's the whole point of it, is to try and lay it out. It's a day you can bring your lawn chair. We're working out an arrangement where you can have some tents on the sides, and people can come and spend the day, bring the kids of all ages, to hear the music. And the other thing that's interesting, it's right next to, or it's in Fort DuPont State Park, and then there's actually hiking trails. There'll be views of the river. And I think people will get an opportunity to see Fort DuPont and Delaware City in a whole different light than they ever seen it before. And they'll also get an opportunity to see some of the plans for the future development of the site.
Okay, so for people who are not familiar with Fort DuPont, talk about the location.
Fort DuPont was actually part of a three-fort system, Fort Mott, New Jersey, Fort Delaware, which is Peapatch Island right off the coast, and then Fort DuPont, which is on the land next, or is part of Delaware City now. And it was a gun battery to defend any invaders, if you will, coming up the Delaware River in the early part of the 20th century. So the property is 400 acres. It was built as a military, an army base. So it has all the elements of a community. It has a church, a theater, different styles of housing. It has a PX, which is like a restaurant complex, and lots of old, beautiful trees and running trails and riding trails, and three giant bunkers that used to be where the gun batteries were to help defend the Delaware River in the event there was any type of problem or issue.
All right, so we're talking to Mark Kleinschmidt about Fort DuPont Redevelopment Corporation hosting its first ever music festival this September. It's going to be on September 29th. It's called Fortify Music Fest. Now, besides the music, which, you know, you outlined a short time ago, talk about what else will be going on as far as food vendors, that sort of thing.
Well, the thing we're trying to do is, obviously, with the music, to create that great sense of atmosphere and excitement and enjoyment, but we will have a lot of local food trucks, which have become incredibly popular in the last couple of years. So we're in the process of having them lined up, and we'll also have a beer garden, which will feature Delaware craft beers. And that's the thing, we're trying to use this as an opportunity to feature and support our local businesses. Craft brewing in the country has just, you know, taken off as an industry, and Delaware is clearly, you know, part of that. One of the things that we're doing is we're looking to develop one of the bunkers into a restaurant craft beer facility, a complex.
Wow.
And for it's really a unique feel when you see these old bunkers and the gun pits that are there. So it'll be a great adaptive reuse. So we've actually already partnered with a local brewer, Twin Lakes Brewing Company, and they will be making for us Fortify IPA, which is a special brew that will be available, making its debut at the Fortify Music Fest. So we're real excited about that, and we're also real excited to be working with Twin Lakes to produce this special beer.
This sounds like a great day. Early bird tickets are now on sale for this event. Yes, Mark?
Yes, we've got the general admission price is $50, but we have an early bird special up to August 1st, where tickets are available for $35 per person. And they can be purchased online at fortifyfest.com.
Okay, and like you said, they're 35 now. That's a great deal. That gets you into Fort Delaware and into Fort DuPont and into the music festival. What about parking?
Parking is right on site, and that's the amazing thing about Fort DuPont. There's no lack of land, lots of open space, and the open space will be preserved as we move forward with future development. But with a lot of that space, we will be able to park probably over, you know, 2,500 cars. That will be a very short walk from there to, you know, where the concert area is going to be. And the concert area will be, you know, a tree-lined area, almost like a grove, and there'll be a view of the Delaware River. So it's a very unique site. So it won't be like the experience if you happen to go to Philadelphia to a baseball game or a football game or a concert up there and you got to park a mile, literally a mile away and walk. It'll be a nice, short, pleasant, tree-lined walk to the concert area.
Mark, we haven't mentioned hours. What time does the whole thing start, and how long do you expect it to go?
Gates will open at noon, and the music will start at 1 and go till 9 p.m. We've got all the bands slotted in for about an hour. Some of the larger bands, the name acts like Kashmir, which is the Led Zeppelin tribute band, they are probably the number one Led Zeppelin band in the tribute band in the country. They'll be our, you know, our headliner at the end of the day, and they'll be coming on around 7:30, 8 o'clock.
And
we should wrap up around 9.
People can come and go at will, of course.
Yes, yes. So people can come and decide how they want to experience Fortify. They want to come in the early morning or not the, or the early afternoon to enjoy the local bands playing that music and take a hike, or, you know, in through the fair or the fort property, or come later in the day to hear, you know, the jam bands with Steal Your Peach, which is the Allman Brothers Grateful Dead group, and Montana Wild Axe, which is a long-standing Delaware favorite, and then hear the Led Zeppelin groups, and then have a great evening.
All right, so the first ever Fortify Music Fest coming to Fort DuPont September 29th. Anything that we left out that people need to be aware of about this music festival?
No, they can find out all the information online at fortify.fest, and it's meant to be a family-friendly, fun day. So you can make a whole day of it, you know, bring, you know, a tent, chairs, literally set up camp at the fort, and enjoy the music, the sights and sounds. And maybe have a good, delicious craft beer or two.
Thanks to Fortify Fest Festival Coordinator Mark Kleinschmidt and our Kelly Steele for their time in this week's Arts Playlist. More ticket information for Fortify Fest is available at our website, DelawarePublic.org. And The Green concludes in just a moment with Enlighten Me and more from our youth media project, Generation Voice, at WMPH and Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. In this week's Enlighten Me, we return again to our Generation Voice Youth Media Project at WMPH and Mount Pleasant High School in the Brandywine School District to highlight work done this year by students in the program. As the school year ended, some of the younger students were asked to produce a commentary, offering a snapshot of their state of mind as they wrapped up another year and looked ahead to the summer and next fall. We'll check out a handful of these commentaries this week, starting with Zaria Young, who just wrapped up her freshman year. She reflects on navigating her first year of high school.
Leaving eighth grade left a weird feeling in me, as if there are butterflies just flying around my stomach. I was so nervous thinking about what high school would be like as a freshman at Mount and who I would sit with at lunch. Or maybe, was I still the tallest in my class? And I wanted to know what classes I had and who I had them with. I wondered, would I fit in as an IB kid or would I feel miserable at Mount? It was so many thoughts going through my head and I didn't know what to do. I begged my mom to get me to Shadow at Mount so I would not be as scared and so I could get used to the school earlier than any other freshman would. So on February 18th, 2017, I shadowed an IB student, and she told me everything I needed to know as a starter here at Mount. She told me that it's not as hard as it looks, but she did say to do my work and stay focused, or I will struggle. So on September 8th, 2017, when we started school, I went to my classes and I barely knew anybody. All of my friends were all in honors and I was the only IB kid. And I was afraid that I wouldn't make friends because I'm so shy and quiet. As school started, I found it kind of easy and it was kind of fun. And within like 4 weeks, one of my friends from elementary transferred, so that was good. We helped each other get all our work in and we had fun while doing it. School was fine with her. She's like my best friend. And school was kind of getting hard and we were getting frustrated really quick. Market periods 1 and 2 were okay. Not too hard, not too easy, but I felt like I could have done better if I focused more. I got stressed over homework and tests coming up, and I felt like I should just give up. Of course I didn't, because I'm still a freshman. We all go through this. And market period 3 left me scared again. I had butterflies again, thinking like, how will I get through it? I'm so stressed. But I ended up having to study every night, staying after school once or twice a week. I just was under so much pressure, and it was a struggle because I wanted to go outside and hang with my friends and just have fun. But I was stuck doing work. I guess it's good because it all paid off. But now it's the 4th market period, and I'm actually doing great. Like, before the 4th market period started, I was on my toes, scared, stressing, because like all these market periods are so short and I had so much work to do. But I'm glad to say that the year is over and that I passed. I had some fun times and stressful times, but the year is over. My freshman year is over. My first year, it's over. It wasn't as bad, but I have a wide awakening for 10th grade. Dear sophomore year, I'm ready for you.
Thanks to rising sophomore Zaria Young. Now we hear from Shafria Davis, who just completed her sophomore year. She says she's already worrying about being a junior and how to deal with the stress that's building.
My name is Shafria, and this is my commentary on the life of a teenager. 16 years of age, and I honestly feel like I'm 7. School is almost out. And I feel great. But what about all the stress and anxiety of the next school year? Junior year, the most viewed year by colleges. Will I have the same friends?
Yeah, I know such
will
such
I have harder classes? Will I have new teachers? I can go all day with these questions. As a freshman, you think high school is a stressful experience, and some people may think it was a piece of cake. And then you get to sophomore year, and then everything becomes a habit for you. You finally work through the year, and the counselors will come down. And now we're talking about SATs and college searching. Like, but SATs, I'm not even ready. What if you don't do good on it? Your grade is too low for the college that you want to get into. What if you don't get into the college that you want to get into? I don't want to be working at a fast food restaurant for the rest of my life. As a 16-year-old, you're pressured to get a job and do summer work and volunteer. What will happen to my summertime? My personal time? The best thing to do is just relax and take the year one step at a time. Focus on yourself in the summer, improve your skills in your favorite sport, or make new friends. Do your summer work, search for a summer job, and build yourself up as a person. School will always be there, and so will the opportunity, and your summer is the doorway to all of your opportunities. Take the advantage of it and step out of your comfort zone, especially before you step into junior year. Junior year is all about your schoolwork, so if you go in stress-free in the year, you'll be perfectly fine. Who needs another stressful year of their school life? Nobody. This is also the time to try new things. Experiment with different classes. Take the AP classes you've been thinking about, play sports you've always wanted to, and join the club that your friends keep talking about. It'll always be worth it at the end. Definitely have good friendships with your teachers. It will help you when you need help and better understanding for the classwork. When you take your classes as a joke or don't really have relationships with the teachers, their support will slowly become distant. Teachers aren't going to be as supportive, but will still be nice. It's your turn to take responsibility for your schoolwork. Teachers are there to guide you, not be your babysitter. The longer you take to realize this, the harder it will be for you to maintain a healthy educational life. Sophomore year is another way to prepare yourself for junior year, so take it seriously. You take your PSATs to prepare you for SATs, and you pick classes that will prepare you for your senior year. Sophomore year is when you need to take all the risks you can, but keep a focus on your schoolwork. Relationships and friends aren't your top priority, even though they are nice to have. It's important for you to focus on yourself and maintain your happiness. Get the summer job and earn your money and get everything you want. Don't rely on your parents or any adults to do everything for you anymore. It's time to be your own boss and be your own adult. It's okay for occasional help, but you need to be as independent as possible. This also helps other people take you seriously. You learn so much in the few years of high school, but keeping up with yourself can be mixed in with the hassles that you forget about. To all the upcoming freshmen, you need to learn how to keep your happiness.
Thanks to rising junior Shafria Davis. Next up, we hear from another rising junior, Sean Coulter, and how the past school year changed him.
As I reflect upon another year, I look back on all the things I accomplished, the ways that I changed. This year was no different. I did a lot. I had a lot of fun and made a lot of memories. I think that among these was meeting new people and getting out more than ever before. Not to say I didn't have friends or anything, or that I didn't hang out with them, because I did. I just didn't do it very often. I enjoyed my solitary time after school. It was quiet. But eventually, this year, I realized how lame that is. I got so bored all of a sudden, I started going bowling. Bowling! So then after the whole bowling debacle, I decided I would start hanging out with my friends, going to the movies with them. That might be what changed it all. My movie viewing habits. I have a card that lets me see one free movie a day. It let me see all the new action blockbusters or sappy romances with my friends. It was fun, and honestly, I think it's what led to me actually enjoying spending time with them outside of school. Originally, I always just figured that I enjoyed doing things better myself, because sometimes people get carried away. Let's take a trip down memory lane, shall we? Back to a camp out I had with a couple of friends last year. We had just gotten done tying one of them up with duct tape when my one friend said, "One second, I have an idea," and left the tent. Next thing I know, he yells, "Smoke grenade incoming," and popped an actual smoke grenade into the tent. The fuse was still sparking, so it lit the tent on fire. I didn't know what to do. My one friend was still tied up. My other friend had to grab the flaming fireball that was the grenade and throw it out of the tent. The sleeping bag was on fire. We put it out and we all got out of there with our lives, luckily. And we had to go and sleep in the car, because none of us could breathe in the tent anymore. So we go to the car, and it's in the middle of this very creepy field, and we're all tense, and it's so, like, we were so scared, we couldn't sleep. And so we're sitting there, like, this ominous feeling, this just immense dread is falling over us. Like, we're literally shaking, and just staring out at this field. Next thing I know, my friend goes, "Hey, what's that out the window?" And I look to my right, and all I see is a face of what looks like an old woman pressed against the passenger side door. We all started screaming and trying to lock the doors. I mean, shrieking. Like, we were loud for 1 a.m. Turns out, when we got a light on, it was our friend's long-haired father telling us to be quiet since it was, well, it was 1 a.m. These are the type of experiences you have as a teenager with your friends in high school. The hangouts, the get-togethers, the memories. See that full circle type thing right there I just did? That was nice. Anyway, they're all so important in shaping our personalities. Some people say you can't choose your family, but you can choose your friends. Why can't I choose both? Some of my friends I do consider family. Not many, but there's some you stick your neck out for in any situation, unless it involves me, like, sacrificing my life for theirs, in which case there's no way at all that I'm watching your back. Like, I'm just not into losing my life. No matter who. I will live with the guilt, because at least I'm still living. But that's theoretical. That's not the point. The point is that friends are important, and they're a huge part of what makes high school enjoyable. Life is all about relationships. They're the thing that make life worth living, that give you a purpose. And this is the year I built most of mine. Through Ultimate Frisbee, going to movies, and being more open-minded with people rather than just avoiding them, actually giving them a chance to be my friend and finding out how nice and funny some of them can be, some of them. I was more charismatic and talkative to people I didn't know, and because of that, I made friends that will last a lifetime. This year was the year I truly found a group of friends that I can call family. Thank you for listening to my commentary.
Thanks to rising junior Sean Coulter. And finally, we turn to Jackie Palmer, who was a sophomore this past school year. She offers a very personal reflection on her life and how it's changed recently.
My life was never really the traditional family, white picket fence, American kind of dream life. Many of my friends lived with their mom and dads. I lived with my grandparents. My biological mom wasn't in the picture, and my dad was addicted to drugs and in and out of jail. Also my life. As I was younger, I never really realized why I lived with my grandparents or why he was in and out. When I got older, I started to understand, but by then it was already too late. My dad was in jail for multiple charges, sentenced 5 years. I was 8. He got out when I was 13. I was a stubborn kid. I wouldn't talk to him for a few weeks. He lived with me and my grandparents. After a year or two, we grew closer. Then he met this girl who he married after only knowing for a few months. She was nice at first. I moved in with him. I was happy for a year or two. We did everything together. It was a white picket fence dream, the one I always dreamed about. Things started to change fast, and I saw the real version in my father that I was always warned about. He was back on drugs. At the time, I was in a serious relationship, and still am to this day, and he noticed that change in me as my father grew to be very mentally abusive towards me. So my boyfriend confronted me and told me how I needed to get out of there. It was easier said than done. June 17th, my life changed forever. I was planning this for a few weeks prior. Everyone in my family knew before him. Before leaving, I found my dad's drug stash, and any doubt about leaving was completely gone. I knew I was in danger. I said I was babysitting my nieces and nephews, so he drove me all the way up to Lancaster, Pennsylvania from Newport, Delaware. A normal 45-minute to an hour trip felt like it lasted weeks. Watching him drive away, still clueless till what was happening, was the biggest relief of my life I've ever felt. It was like I was finally free. About 3 days later, I moved in with my boyfriend, leaving everything I owned back at my father's house. The next few weeks were hard. I cried a lot. Things got better. My boyfriend was my rock. He made me smile and laugh and was always a shoulder to cry on.
How are you?
Then there was his little brother. He's 5 and has Down syndrome. The moment I met him, he stole my heart. Never did I think in my life these two boys were going to change my life for the better. This summer, I found out how strong I really was. Always hold your head up and stay strong, listeners. Also, I hope you have a great summer. Thank you for listening.
Thanks to rising junior Jackie Palmer and all the Mount Pleasant High students we heard from this week. A reminder that all these pieces are part of Generation Voice, our collaboration with the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School and its radio station WMPH. Our youth media producer, Sophia Schmidt, oversees Generation Voice for us, working with Mount Pleasant teacher Paul Wishingrad, who runs the career pathway that we work with there. And that's all we have time for On the Green this week. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to the Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out the Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Mount Pleasant High School students Sean Coulter, Shafria Davis, Jackie Palmer, and Zaria Young, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalina and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.